sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It is a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. This morning, Ton and I are joined by Sheridan Hansen, which listeners are pretty familiar with now. Sheridan's with us. Or Sheridan is with us. I'll wake up here. I know I'm going to wake up any minute. Sheridan's been with us a number of times and has done a number of wonderful videos. So, Sheridan, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
You are so sweet, and I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me, both of you.
We wanted to start out with the plant of the week, which is the forsythia, which I know neither one of you love the forsythia. But the thing about the forsythia is it's like our hope for a gardening season because it is the first, it's pretty much the first bush that starts to bloom where you actually are seeing some flowers.
Winter hazel. No, I'm just kidding.
I heard
Ton already knows
this
how
morning
I feel about winter hazel.
You don't like winter hazel.
Well, it is just so weird looking.
It is odd. I think
like
for Cynthia,
a spider
can look just as odd too. I mean, not spidery like witch hazel, but yeah, I agree with that hope. Like the forsythia gives you that spring is coming. I've made it through winter, one more winter, right? And it's going to get better. But I also think, like, forsythia, you know, in my mind, if you don't plant the right variety, it looks like somebody just stepped out of the house out of bed and didn't put any effort into how they look. Mm-hmm. So that's my feeling about forsythia.
Yeah, but, you know, with my kind of caution about the shrub when it's, you know, not in bloom, when it comes into bloom in the spring, there's nothing that beats it. Even other flowering shrubs cannot compare to how beautiful the forsythia is for that 2 or 3 weeks that it's in bloom.
Right. There's no doubt when you're driving down the street and you've just come off winter where everything is just like twigs and stuff, when you see that vibrant yellow, it definitely grabs your attention.
Yeah. What better color to have right off the bat than yellow? Like, so happy, so bright, so in your face.
It is. And so we've posted a fact sheet of several varieties that you can find online or purchase from local garden centers. And over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of many introductions that will grow anywhere from a couple feet high up to 10 to 12 feet high. Many of them have improved bud hardiness or better showy flowers. And so, you know, there's some old-fashioned Linwood Gold, and there's a few others out there that are fine, but a lot of these newer varieties, you know, for smaller lots are very useful because they only get 2 or 3 feet tall.
Well, and I would argue even not for smaller lots, but because they do look like a better specimen. I mean, it's a much better look to have a shorter, less gangly looking shrub that you're trying to control with pruning cuts, which, I mean, let's face it, a lot of the times with forsythia, they end up being not great pruning cuts. It doesn't ever look awesome with those big, huge, gangly shrubs. So even in large spaces, I would argue that some of these forsythias that are smaller can be planted in mass or multiples of 3 or 5, and you can really get a beautiful splash of color first thing in the spring.
We know people love their forsythia, though.
Oh, yeah.
I know we've entered some dangerous territory here because people love them. And I think they're more for people who don't want so much of a formal garden. They're kind of more free thought people,
oh, yeah.
I guess, you know, so that kind of more gangly, spread out kind of look doesn't bother them as much as somebody who wants to keep their plants under control.
And, you know, that's the thing with forsythia is if you are going to prune it, keep it in that natural state, in my mind anyway. There are people that will hedge it.
Oh.
And I just come out of my skin. I'm like, oh, please don't do that. It makes it look so unnatural. And I think it looks best in that natural state.
So if you're going to prune it as soon as it's done blooming, you're going to use renewal pruning, where you're taking 20, 25, 30%, usually around 20 to 25% of the branches out, starting with the biggest, oldest branches toward the base of the shrub. And what this will do is keep the size under control, but it will not hedge it. And if you hedge it, what will happen is you'll have this hedge shrub for 6 or 8 weeks, and then it shoots new growth. And the new growth is very extensive, and it just makes a mess. And so renewal pruning will keep the shape more natural, keep it in check, keep it blooming a lot the next year, and just helps keep its form a little better, even if you have the smaller shrubs.
Is it fair to say that forsythia just wants its space, like it wants to just spread out?
It does. It wants to be that glorious, you know, have that glorious bloom in the spring and be that center of attention, I think. And I think it's fine to let it be that.
So if you're going to plant it, give it its space.
Give it its space, yeah, 100%.
I think appropriate use for forsythia is someplace in the yard that is visible so you can enjoy the beauty of the shrub, but not the focal point of especially your front yard. You know, for the 2 or 3 weeks that you get the flowers, there are many other things you could put there that will be much more formal. And I don't want to say attractive, because beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but will be something that I think a lot more people would accept and say, yeah, that is a focal point. That should be something saying, you know, this is leading to my front door, or yes, this is my house.
Yeah.
And it is beautiful in the spring.
Absolutely.
When it's blooming. How long does it actually bloom, though?
A couple weeks, if you're lucky. I think it depends
on
temperature.
Get 2 weeks of really beautiful blooms and then kind of gangly
if
bush.
The temperatures are in the mid-50s to low-60s. It can last at least 2 weeks. And what will happen is the flowers are still on the shrub, but the leaves start to grow and obscure the flowers, and then they start to drop.
Okay, before we break, though, Sheridan, you were talking about one forsythia that you did like that you saw overseas, but we're not sure if we can get it here.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it comes here. And it was stunning. And I was somewhere in Europe. I can't remember exactly where. But it was like a prostrate, kind of rambling, low to the ground forsythia. And it looked almost like a river of yellow. And it was beautiful. And, you know, being in a foreign country, all that, I didn't get all the details for it, but I do know that we make some low growing types, and they are listed on that fact sheet. So something to maybe consider
depending on the look you want.
Yeah, yeah. And there are once in a while forsythia that are grafted onto a standard, people I guess would call them tree form. They're not really going to be a tree. It's just more they're on a single trunk and then the shrub is there. And I have seen some of the weeping forms, almost like a weeping cherry. They're a little bit more upright, but that same feel. And so when you do find them like that, you do need to stake them for a number of years until the trunk is strong enough to support the canopy. But those are occasionally available too.
All right. Plant of the week for forsythia. You can find out more on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We're going to take a break. Come back with your calls and questions. Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Sheridan Hansen joining us this morning. Taking your calls and questions, Drew is first on the line this morning. Good morning, Drew. How can we help you?
Good morning. I have a hedge that I've made out of red dogwood, and it's about 4, 4.5 feet high, and I'd like to reduce its height to about 3 feet. Can I do that, and what time?
Oh, absolutely. You can do that. And I mean, if it's a hedge, you're going to just take hedging pruners and go for it. And that can be done early spring. Just hedging pruners, you can take, an electric hedging shear if you would like to. That will make your job a lot easier rather than having, a pruner that you're going to have to cut every single branch if you're doing a hedge. And that will help it fill in and become really nice and thick. But you can do that early spring.
Great. I'm looking forward to March. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning. The first texter of the morning has 3 flowering crab apples. They've never pruned them. They want to know when would be a good time.
The crab apples are generally pruned in mid-March. or excuse me, mid-February. Just the reason you prune in mid-February is that it helps prevent the spread of a disease called fire blight. And if you prune later, you know, into mid-March when we do the stone fruits, oftentimes fire blight is becoming active and it has active cankers that are oozing, and you get your pruners in it. And so we prune a little earlier, and the crab apples and other apples and pears will tolerate pruning during colder weather than other fruit trees will.
Aren't you going to cut off all the blooms, though?
Not really. If you only take 25% of the foliage, there will still be plenty of blooms there.
You know, flowers are my whole reason for gardening. So if you take away the flowers, I'm not going to be so happy.
Yes.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Okay, so number to call with your questions, and the phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Next listener says they have a Rose of Sharon, and it looks like it has cotton strings coming out of it. What is that?
Ooh, that
cotton
could be...
strings? I have never heard that.
I haven't heard of strings. I mean, we have things like woolly aphids that can sometimes show up, but they wouldn't be stringy.
No, I'm trying to think of anything beyond spider webs. Pictures are worth a thousand words here, most likely.
Okay, so absolutely. Facebook Messenger is the only way to
yes,
send us pictures.
Do not text us pictures.
So last week, Ton, people got super excited about gardening because we had two or three days where we were like, what, close to 60 degrees or over 60 degrees. And today people are thinking, I don't know, it's back to winter and freezing, so not as many calls and questions.
You know, it's actually times like this that I think are a benefit because it just calms people down and just, you know, that re la harse, tranquilo, you know, just calm down. It is February, and even though we were 60 for a few days, you've got until at least mid-March, especially without seasonal protection, you know, the low tunnels and different things to plant.
So people do get excited. They pull out the shears and think they can just start doing all sorts of things. So what are kind of the dangers of like starting to trim everything out in the yard?
Not a lot. I mean, you will sacrifice.
You can cut some of those branches yeah. off the euonymus and it's not going to be a big deal.
No. And mid-March is the time to do it. But it looks like this weather pattern is holding that we're going to be in the 40s and 50s with a high 20s at night. And if weather is like that and doesn't drop much lower, then the pruning danger isn't really there for a lot of our shrubs. But if we were to go out and do a bunch of pruning and then all of a sudden drop back down to 5 degrees or 10 degrees, then you could do a lot of damage. And so we always tell people, you know, that mid-March for most shrubs and your stone fruits is because that danger of the temperature dropping isn't there nearly as much as it is in February. But if you have to, because you're busy with work, going out of town or whatever, relying on a commercial service, as long as the temperatures stay above 10 degrees, especially for your fruit trees, for 7 to 10 days after they're pruned, then you can generally go ahead and do it this time of year.
We were talking about some of the things are starting to come up. We're starting to see a few little greens from the crocus and things because of those warmer temperatures. You mentioned you had somebody who was concerned about their garlic maybe suffering as a result. And so what's your best advice for someone like that?
Well, they had covered the garlic in stir manure, trying to keep the stir manure breaks down and stays warm. And don't do that because it's just kind of icky for it's an edible and just... Yeah, and so if you need to do that, Sheridan has done this before, and maybe I'll let her describe what she does with garlic.
Yeah, so I mulch on top with a really nice thick layer of straw, and sometimes the garlic will still pop through the straw, and you may get a little bit of tip burn on some of those leaves if we have a really cold night, but it's okay. The garlic is going to continue to grow. You're not going to kill that garlic, but having that really thick layer of leaf mulch or straw, I found straw just to be the absolute best for garlic because it is porous, it allows air, and it allows water to move through, and it doesn't smother things, where sometimes leaves will bunch up and get, you know, they'll hold a lot of moisture, and that can cause some problems for your garlic. You know, we don't want to promote any kind of rot or too much moisture. So I just think straw is awesome. So stop by a local farm store, talk to your neighbor who may have, you know, animals, and see if you can purchase a bale of straw, and that will really help. And people always worry about the weeds that come up from straw. you're going to have a few. It's not excessive. The great thing about it is it's coming up in straw bedding and it's really easy to pull out. So it's not something I typically worry about, but people do have that thought quite often.
You answered my big question is where in the world do I get straw? I mean, during Halloween, I know where to get it, but where do I get it this time?
So IFA, local farm stores.
Yeah, independent farm stores.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely have it.
Go ahead.
If you jump on KSL Classifieds, there are often farmers selling straw and hay by the 50-pound bale. And so you may be able to find it if you live, you know, I'm down in Santaquin and we still have a lot of farms. If you're in, you know, near the Great Salt Lake or northern Davis into Weber, Box Elder counties, you can sometimes find it for $3 or $4 less a bale from one of the local farmers than you can from a retailer. But it's just really easy to go into, especially IFA, and pick up a bale of straw.
Yeah, in Holiday, I don't have any farm neighbors, so I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, you just got to find that farm store. And we should talk about, there's definitely a difference between straw and hay. And make sure you don't pick up hay. Straw has a hollow center that will hold air in it and will become a good insulator. Hay doesn't have that necessarily. So
denser, wasting animal feed.
Absolutely. And it's going to have a lot more seed in it, where straw will be a lot less. So make sure you pick up the right product.
It's good to make that distinction for me personally.
Yeah. For everybody, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
Not just me. Okay. Next listener says, when should they prune a snowberry bush? I'm not sure I know what a snowberry bush
Snowberries is. Snowberries are a shade-tolerant plant. We have some native species. There's the group is native to the northern hemisphere, and their claim to fame, depending on the species, like snowberry has a white berry on it midsummer through fall, and then the related species like coral berry has this really pretty purple berry, and they will tolerate dry shade quite well. And so they're not super common. They are available, but they're very useful in those dry shade areas. And so when I would prune them, they're going to flower in the spring. And so you definitely would not want to give them a haircut, and you would use renewal pruning. And you could do some pruning if you didn't take more than 25% of the branches out in either mid-March, or you could wait till they were done blooming and do that sometime in mid to late April.
All right. We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Come back with your calls and questions. Phone lines are open. 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Tom Bettis, Sheridan Hansen with you this morning, taking your calls and your questions. We'll take your calls at 801-575-8255. Your questions at 57500. Rick is on the line in Orem, and good morning, Rick. What can we help you with?
Hang on. Yes, I've got a question about fruit trees. Question is, question I have is, I'm replacing some fruit trees, taking out apple trees and putting in peach trees. Do I need to fumigate the soil? Can I put one fruit variety in where another has been there, whether it's peach apple or apple apple? How do I replace trees adequately properly?
We don't generally have a lot of problems with replant disease here that they experience in other parts of the country, and especially if you're following from apple to peach or even apple to apple, you'll be okay. There's nothing that you could purchase to fumigate the soil with anyway that you could get without a restricted use license, and they're only registered for agricultural use. So, I mean, if you wanted to try something, you would have to literally grow broccoli or a cabbage and get it up 6 inches to a foot and then till it under and cover it with plastic for a week or two to do some natural fumigation. And it's just not worth it. And there's very minimal risk. So I would just go ahead and do what you plan on doing.
Okay.
All right.
Very good.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks
this morning.
Much.
Next listener says, how can you best help a mature bur oak with iron chlorosis? They've had the trunk injected for the past couple of years with some success, but they're wondering if there's something else they can do.
Well, we were kind of hashing through this on the break, and honestly, bur oak is a really tough tree that's very well adapted to the Utah soil. conditions that we have. I'm wondering if there's some overwatering going on that would induce that iron chlorosis, because that's not something we typically see in that tree, right, Ton?
It's not. And the only other factors I could think of is if there is an internal vascular wilt disease that's clogging some of the conductive tissue and preventing nutrient uptake. And there's nothing you can do about that. And then excessively salty soil, but oak trees will tolerate salty soil up to an EC, electrical conductivity, of about 2.5 or 3 before they're really impacted. And so I would suspect too much water, or maybe a wilt disease that it's tolerating but not thriving because of it.
Yeah.
Next listener says they planted raspberries last year. They did well. They didn't do any pruning or anything to them before the winter. They're wondering if they should be doing some pruning this spring.
Absolutely. Raspberries do need to be pruned. It depends on what type of raspberry you have, if it's a summer bearing or a fall bearing, or sometimes June bearing or fall bearing is what they're referred to as. And that will kind of dictate how you prune. USU has some excellent fact sheets that go through the entire process of pruning raspberries. So based on that type of fact sheet, I would say to you, type in pruning raspberries and then put summer bearing or fall bearing and USU in your search bar and it will pop right up for you. But fall bearing, you know, you can take down to the ground. Summer bearing or June bearing are a little more complicated in that we have to identify raspberry canes that are 1 to 2 years old and take out the appropriate canes.
Next listener says they've had leaf hoppers on their grapes for the past 5 years. They've used permethrin, spinosad, etc., but they continue to return. They say last week while cleaning up, they were like me out cleaning up leaves last week, they noticed them hibernating in and under the dried leaves, which are now removed. Is there anything to use now to kill them before the grapes come out?
What would you think of a dormant, delayed dormant spray?
I think you could do it if you did it early enough on the grapes. And
so we're
sensitive.
Talking sooner.
Yeah.
But then if they come back in midsummer, unfortunately, permethrin spinosad isn't just, it's not going to cut the mustard. You're going to have to use permethrin or something a little bit higher power to get rid of them just because of the numbers. I mean, if you monitor and when you first see them, start spraying. But with leaf hoppers, you have to spray the undersides of the leaves, not just the surface.
Yeah, which is hard to do.
Yeah, they're saying that these are near a walkway, which makes it even more pesky. They're wondering if there's some sort of dredge or beneficials or host plants, diatomaceous earth, anything they can do.
I wouldn't do a systemic just because we're going to be eating that fruit.
Yeah, so systemics are out.
Yeah, so that makes it a little bit tougher. And the thing with leafhoppers is they move. So you may get rid of a population. You've got more moving, and they're difficult to deal with.
I've been recommending people use maybe like the Pet Garden and Livestock that's 10% permethrin as a spray to knock them back. And they're spraying under the leaves inside the plants and then shift over to spinosad or triple action or something once a week for 3 or 4 weeks to see if they can knock out any eggs that are hatching or any younglings, so to speak, to go that way.
I think that's a good idea because, you've got multiple action that will help from different types of chemicals. And then you are reapplying. And
yes.
I think that's the key right there.
It is. And the other thing with grapes is if you are not pruning your grapes and they are just a big mess of vines and you can't, and the vines are going clear to the ground, you're not going to get rid of leaf hopper. The grapes need to be pruned. And you need to have airspace underneath with that controlled growth to really control them. And so if they've been growing on a chain link fence for 30 years, never pruned, it's going to be much more difficult to get rid of them. And in that situation, you may need to use a systemic and just not harvest the grapes for a year to see if you can get rid of them.
Right.
All right. Jim is on the line in Bountiful. Jim, what was your question?
Is it time to start pruning fruit trees?
On some of them, yes, absolutely. So apples, pears, as long as our temperatures are staying above 10 degrees at night, you can do some of those more hardy, tough types of fruit trees. I would wait on the stone fruits, so peaches and plums, things like that, until a little bit later in the season, usually mid-March. So we usually start mid-February with those tougher trees, and then we move to the more tender trees into mid-March.
So like the apricots, you wait until a little later on, not just the seed fruit you prune now?
Yeah, well, apricots are a little bit tougher. What do you think about that, Ton?
If you can, I would wait until mid-March. But if you just have that need to get out there and start pruning stuff, you know, you're probably going to be okay just because the apricots, they bloom early, but they're a little more cold hardy than the other stone fruits. But
peaches, you can go ahead and...
No. Apples and pears you can prune now. The stone fruit, so the apricots, peaches, cherries, mid-March. So you've got another month on those.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, Jim. Thanks for your call this morning. Joe is texting in. He's a first-time seed grower. He needs a little bit of help here. He's using a grow box with lighting and a heat mat. The lights are 3 to 4 inches above the soil. They're on for about 12 hours a day. He says his onion and lettuce seedlings are long and spindly and wants to know what he's doing wrong and does he need to fertilize.
I'm wondering if the temperature's too high. So a lot of the times with some of these colder hardy varieties of vegetables like onion and lettuce, they can tolerate a little bit lower temperature. So once they germinate, get them off that heat mat. And that will help to reduce the growth because sometimes the growth is too fast and then we get some kind of gangly things. And also, I mean, it sounds like he's got the lights really low. You want him to be an inch or two above if you can. If you can lower them just a little bit and take that temperature down, it might help a bit.
So now that they're gangly, is there going to be any way to kind of, does he have to start over?
No, I think the onions will be fine. I mean, the lettuce, it's such a short-lived crop anyway. Let it grow, let it do its thing, start your next batch. Because with lettuce, you're going to want to be continually sowing every couple of weeks anyway. So, because it just, you're going to use it so quickly.
Okay, we're going to take a break, come back with more of your calls and questions. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan with you this morning. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Next texter says they have a tree of paradise that they poisoned with concentrated Roundup last fall. When can they start cutting it down? This is Steve.
Well, I mean, as soon as it's dead, don't you think, Ton?
Yeah, I might wait to make sure it's not shooting any new growth.
I was
going to
say, how do you know it's dead?
And it may leaf out and then collapse like 3 weeks later. Not literally, but the leaves wither because there's sometimes stored energy in the branches, but the roots might be dead and the branches may not be completely there. But I wouldn't get ahead of myself just in case, because if it's still alive and you cut that trunk, it might make it angry.
Right. And you want to make sure that those trees are really good and dead. And I applaud you for killing that tree. Thank you. That's such an odd thing to say, but thank you.
No. When the next person says, when is the best time to prune a red bud? It's fairly large, has fairly large limbs that hit them in the head when they're mowing. They need to prune a bit.
Oh, you know, they're in the legume family. They flower early. You could prune it when it's nice and dormant. I mean, you don't want to lose that bloom, though. So what do you think, Ton? Would you wait?
If pruning it before May, it would recover just fine. But it's one of those things that you're torn because references will say, well, mid-January or mid-March or after it's done blooming. And all of them, I think, are okay. But I think the safest time is probably now if it's just one or two limbs.
Okay.
Just, you will lose some flowers and it may try to shoot a whole bunch of new branches where you cut, but look up on how to make pruning cuts so that you don't cause more damage and don't leave stubs. But I would just get it out now.
Yeah, get it done with.
But don't cut more than about 20% of the canopy out of the tree.
Yeah, and honestly, with a red bud, I'd only cut the things that were hitting you in the head.
Yeah.
Our next listener says they read an article about a new purple tomato full of antioxidants, and they're wondering if that's real or if it's a gimmick. That's the problem with all this stuff out on social media, right?
Yeah, right. So you're constantly sifting through all the info trying to find out what's real. But yes, anthocyanins are the chemical, I guess you would say, the compound in the fruit that makes it turn purple. And yes, they are high in antioxidants. And in fact, I believe it's Burpee that has done some breeding for tomatoes that are extra high in antioxidants. So yes, they definitely are higher.
Okay, and we should mention that we're going to talk about heirloom tomatoes at the top of the hour. That's the top of the hour feature, so keep listening for that. Next person says, how early can they plant grass seed? They live in the Orem area about a mile from the lake.
Any time, but it won't germinate until the soil temperatures are 50 or 55 degrees. And so if you need to get it down, you can, but the dangers you run into are birds will come and pick at it because they're running out of food sources. And so you would also maybe want to put a quarter of an inch of finely ground mulch or peat moss over the top, and you could just let it sit and time it. You know, we're supposed to be fairly clear for the next week. I would time it with a rainstorm or a snowstorm if you have to, but I think the best time to do it, if you can wait, is sometime early to mid, maybe late April, depending on the weather.
Okay, next listener says, their rose bushes have new growth because of those warm temperatures. Is that harmful? Will those branches die off?
I mean, if our temperatures drop really severely, they definitely could die off. I would just leave it, let it do its thing. Usually they'll harden themselves back off when the temperatures do drop, as long as it's not really fast and really sudden. So,
my rose bushes still have leaves on them.
Yeah, so do mine. They never dropped, but they will this spring. Once they start pushing new growth, they should drop those old leaves.
When would folks want to start pruning their rose bushes?
Mid-March. And
put the pruners away. Don't touch the rose bushes.
We have to have these lessons to where we have to have people turn them over to a significant other that isn't the yard worker and hide them until it's time. But yeah, for your hybrid tea roses, those are the ones that you would cut and bring inside mid-March, and you cut them depending on the size. If it's a super old bush, then cut it back to four or five main canes around knee height, maybe a little shorter. If it's a newer one, you know, 3 or 4 years old, two or three main canes, and they'll come back. We like to get ahead of ourselves, but roses are actually, especially most of the hybrid teas, are very wimpy plants.
Oh, they are. They're just not tough at all. They're the prima donnas.
They are. They are. And there are some, the David Austin roses are a little better. They're more disease resistant. And some of the hybrid teas are more cold hardy, but they are barely hardy on the Wasatch Front.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just be careful. And like Ton said, put the pruners away, lock them up, because pruning can cause more problems right now for them. So
we only have a couple of minutes before the top of the hour news, but I did want to mention something that we were talking about earlier. We were talking about unique things that you can plant, unique vegetables. But the thing that really stands out we need to tell folks is, if you want to start planting some of these more unique things, Sheridan, you found that they better do it quickly, find those seeds quickly.
Right. So if you are sourcing seeds from online catalogs or stores that way, you might want to start thinking about getting your seeds. Some of them are becoming difficult to find at this point. And especially in the online world, and as you are sourcing them, it's not just the local, you know, customer that's sourcing them. It's all over the country, all over the world that's sourcing them. So you're competing with all these people for seeds, and they do sell out quickly. And I've noticed, like, Johnny Seeds doesn't have some of the stock that they normally do. So Burpee's starting to sell out of some things. So get online and get your stuff ordered right away.
Yeah, we have talked to Sheridan a number of times in a number of videos on unique vegetables to plant in your garden. We've talked to her about extending the garden season. So any of those questions that you have, you can ask us during the show. And I do want to talk more later in the show with Sheridan about those unique vegetables. We seem to plant the same old cucumbers, the same old squash, the same. And there are just so many unique varieties that just add color and flavor to our food, to our meals.
Absolutely. I can't wait to talk about it.
Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. The plant of the week this morning was the forsythia, so you can check that out on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. And a reminder that you can always find the KSL Greenhouse in podcast form. So if you get kind of busy on a Saturday morning, but late in the afternoon, you just want to have something wonderful to listen to, you can pull up the podcast at kslpodcast.com. When we come back, we are going to be talking about heirloom tomatoes. That is another area of Sheridan's expertise, so we're going to talk about those. So stay with us. And again, the number to call, 801-575-8255, or text us, 57500.
Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing. I got nothing to do. Hey.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care.
Hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse and spending your Saturday morning with us. This morning, we are joined by Sheridan Hansen, also a horticulturist who we've had on the show a number of times now and done a number of videos with that you can check out on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel as well on extending the gardening season, unique vegetables that you can plant in your vegetable garden here in Utah. This morning, though, we wanted to focus on heirloom tomatoes, another one of Sheridan's expertise. First of all, though, guys, why do we call them heirloom? When I think of heirloom, I think of old. But that's not a very nice way to think of, you know, planting tomatoes.
Well, but I think tomatoes aren't sensitive like us to that kind
that's
of thing.
That's a good thing.
they are old. Some sites say 25 years. Some sites say 50 years old for that same variety.
I've seen some say Victorian era, right. Which I think is a little ridiculous.
I think that's a little much. I usually say 50 when I teach, but, you know, that's just me. And the point is, though, that it's open pollinated so that if a bee or a pollinator comes and pollinates that plant by chance, it's going to still give you that same tomato. And, you know, tomatoes are self-pollinating anyway, so they don't really need the pollinator. But when I save seeds from that plant, I'm going to get 99% of the time, I'm going to get the same plant from that seed that I took the plant from. And so they are genetically stable is what we kind of refer to them as. You can get some really fun, cool varieties. These often have stories, which that's the icing
that
on the cake for
yes.
me. I love the story. I love the history behind it. So it's like meshing history with horticulture, and that right there is just icing on the cake.
The story behind Mortgage Lifter or Bloody Butcher or some of these other...
Maybe you don't want to know the story
yes.
behind it, right? I'm just kidding.
I don't know the story or have even heard of those two.
Yeah, so Mortgage Lifter, you know, that was somebody who had this tomato, sold seeds from it, and they were able to pay off their mortgage, and so hence it was named Mortgage Lifter. So they all come with really fun, interesting kind of background. Some of them have traveled with families from one location to another. So a lot of immigrants or migrants that come to the United States and they bring that plant with them because that is their family tomato. That has been grown on their family farm for hundreds of years. And so they brought that and then they shared it. And that's how we get some of these really unique varieties. So I love them. I know that Ton and I kind of have been on opposite ends of the spectrum, which is kind of fun because he's more of a hybrid guy, which maybe we should define hybrids.
Just my background has been farm production.
Right.
With commercial, you know, fresh market tomatoes, and a lot of the farmers I work for want the highest yields with a good tasting tomato.
Consistency.
But consistent.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've worked with. And
right.
So a hybrid tomato is where they have taken two separate strains of tomato and crossed them. And so the cross, they know how it's going to come out from an F1 hybrid. But when you start getting to the second and third generations, they do not come back genetically the same as the parent. And so if you grow hybrid tomatoes, you don't save the seed. If you do, you get all sorts of things coming back. And even of the offspring, eventually what will happen is they will probably revert back to the parents
mm-hmm.
or something similar, and the tomato will have very different characteristics than what it was. And so an example might be if you had Celebrity Plus and then planted seeds from Celebrity Plus, they wouldn't come back as Celebrity Plus. They would be all over the place. And over a period of years, the offspring would probably revert back to either of the, mostly like the either of their parent plants, which is probably going to be an inferior strain.
Okay. As a gardener, I plant some of each of these.
Right.
Like I plant the Celebrity more for volume and, you know, such. But
I'm very bored already. Like, I want to try new things all the time. I want new flavors in my salads. Otherwise, it's the same old salad, and how many just green salads with tomatoes and cucumbers can you eat, right? And I want those different colors and flavors. So, to me, the heirlooms are just super fun and interesting and delicious.
Right. But, I mean, we definitely lose yield on the heirlooms. They're not going to produce like the hybrids. And a lot of the times, you'll end up with this huge leafy plant with maybe 5 tomatoes on it. So finding the right heirloom for your garden is also important. Now, I stumbled across this new term, and I texted Ton a few weeks ago, and I was like, look, it's like the best of your world and my world coming together, and it's called heirloom tomatoes. So they're taking heirlooms now and hybridizing heirlooms either with a hybrid or with another heirloom. So they're crossing and trying to get the best of both worlds. So we're trying to get the best flavors, the best colors, the best shapes, but also with good yield and good production. And I found this new term, that heirloom, on this website called High Mowing Organic Seeds, which I've ordered from a number of times. And they kind of are specializing in this heirloom kind of moment here, this new idea, which I think is really fun. It's not really a new idea. It's an old idea, but kind of reborn, I think. So I texted Ton and I was like, look, we can meet in the middle. This is awesome. But that would give you, you know, that yield with the great flavors and, you know, that lack of monotony. You're going to have that variety in your salads or in your cooking or whatever you're doing. And, you know, that is a draw for me. So
there are a million heirlooms.
So many. Oh my gosh.
Like if you go to certain places, they have like lists of all the different heirlooms. So I want to know what you have found that is delicious and interesting that actually works well here.
Okay. So yeah, there are several that I absolutely love. One that I will go back to time and time again is Goldman's Italian American tomato. And this is one that has a story that, you know, it's a family that immigrated from Italy. They started a grocery store in New York. They grew this tomato for the grocery store and it took off from there and people saved seeds and planted. And it can be a slicer or it can be a paste tomato, which I absolutely love. I love dual use. Mm-hmm. So if I can use it in a sauce and then also a salad, fantastic. This one is kind of pear-shaped and it has ruffles. So it's, you know, fluted is sometimes what they refer to it as. And it has the most silky, smooth texture on it. I absolutely love that one. There are so many, though, like you said, that, you know, I'm constantly trying something new in my garden. So this year, the only thing I'm replanting is the Goldman's Italian this year as my standard that I will have in the garden. And I'm planting a hybrid that I found last year that I fell in love with from Burpee called Too Tasty. And it's a smaller tomato that starts off with purple shoulders and then it turns red as it matures. And you'll still have a little bit of purple blush on the shoulders. But that one, everybody that tasted that tomato went head over heels for it. It has an incredible flavor and it's an incredible producer. So other than those two this year, I'm trying all new things. And I do this a lot. And it's kind of an act of bravery, I think, on my part, but maybe just a lack of being able to commit myself to one certain tomato. Yeah, maybe I'm bored. I have commitment issues with tomatoes. I don't know. So definitely kind of running the gamut and trying a bunch of different things. One thing that I've really fallen in love with recently as well, and these kind of come under that kind of heirloom category, are the micro dwarf tomatoes. If you have not seen these, and we're going to talk about these when we talk about small space gardening, but these are tiny plants that are incredibly prolific. They produce a ridiculous amount of tomatoes on this small plant. And the one I fell in love with last year was called Groovy Tunes. And that one is a striped tomato. It has the heirloom taste. It has the heirloom look. And then you get that hybridization to get the small size plant as well. So really interesting things that you can kind of dive into here. And I could talk about tomatoes for 12 hours.
And I hope that our listeners want to talk about tomatoes.
And before we go to break, I did want to mention with my adventures in hybrid tomatoes, one thing I have noticed that unless you're growing Celebrity, Early Girl, Better Boy, the varieties in the hybrid tomatoes disappear after 4 or 5 years. You get a favorite one that's super productive and then is gone. So you find another one and it's gone. And so these heirlooms, a lot of times the varieties are going to be more stable in availability over time. And so if you do find a favorite hybrid, unless it's like Celebrity or Celebrity Plus, don't get too addicted to it because it probably will disappear unless it's just wildly popular.
An opportunity to find something new.
It is.
Right. All right, we're going to go to break. Sheridan's going to be with us throughout the show, so you can ask more questions about tomatoes or extending your gardening season, any of those things. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan this morning taking your calls and questions. We do have a listener who wanted us to repeat the varieties of tomatoes that you talked about, Sheridan. I'm going to say Goldman's Italian, because I took notes, because, yes, of course, I have a list of things I need to plant in my yard, and Too Tasty. And if they're looking at the Micro Dwarf, it is Groovy Tunes. And we will try to post some more information about those on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We do have some other callers asking some different seeds, different questions. This one is about seeds, bird seeds. This person loves to feed the birds, but their feeder is dropping the seeds in the lawn. And then, of course, things are sprouting that they don't love. And they want to know, is there any way to get them not to sprout? There isn't, is there?
There isn't. Pre-emergence,
I had to move the bird feeder.
Might help, but short of putting that bird seeder over pavers or a cement pad, I don't know what's going to keep them from germinating.
Yeah, it's kind of a tricky situation.
I mean, the only thing I could think of, and it would be very labor intensive and not practical, is to get a batch of seeds and boil the seeds and then dry them for several days.
Would the birds eat them, though?
Yes, they would. They would once the seeds dried down, but those seeds are no longer viable if they've been boiled. You could try roasting them at 150-160 degrees, almost like you would a peanut, but I don't know what that would do to them.
Now we're cooking for the birds, and I feel like that's a lot of work.
It's energy intensive. I mean, it used to be that,
at least there's an idea,
right,
for spices, when literally kingdoms were built on spice trade and the trade of new and exotic spices. A lot of these spices were seeds, and they, before they were sold, the, you know, beyond the source, they would be boiled ahead of time for just a minute or two to kill them so that they're sterile, so that when you traded the seed, that whoever received them to use them for cooking couldn't grow them. And so it was a thing to do to protect your markets when, you know, in the 15, 16, 1700s, when that the spice trade was literally, you know, kingdoms were built upon it.
You too, and your knowledge of history that goes along with horticulture just is phenomenal.
I did not know that. I just learned something really new. Thanks, Ton.
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay, and you're also a geek. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Next listener wants to know, when and how do they prune a weeping pussy willow tree?
This one, you don't want to go in and cut it like an umbrella. And so it's hanging down, and then you've got this little mushroom shape. And the reason being is that there are secondary buds on those branches. And when they grow out, they'll all grow out horizontally for 5 or 6 inches and then grow down again. And then you'll have a stair shape in the actual weeping pussy willow. And so when you prune them so that some of the branches are maybe 2 feet off the ground, some 2.5, some 3 feet, some 3.5, and you stagger them evenly around so that you can maintain the look of the bush, especially if it's weeping, so that you don't have these silly stairs in there where the branches grew out and then started to weep down again.
All right, Sheridan, this next person had a couple of questions for you. First one, are heirloom tomatoes more susceptible to pests?
Not necessarily. I mean, with some of the hybrids, they will hybridize so that, you know, they're immune, not necessarily immune, but resistant to diseases. And the heirlooms don't have that. But as far as pests go, like insects, no, it's kind of about even with the insects for sure. It's just some of the diseases that are soil-borne pathogens that can be difficult to deal with that they have hybridized to deal with. So
if you're growing the heirlooms, it's critical that you rotate where you plant.
Absolutely, 100%. You do need to rotate. And I would say that with your garden in general, just rotate that garden.
Their second question was, well, first of all, they said that they're glad you're still doing your Utah Farm Gal on Instagram.
Oh, thanks for hanging out with me there.
But they're wondering if you're going to still be doing Garden Guys and Gal.
No. So that has kind of come to a close for the time being. So, okay. Yeah, we'll see where that goes. But you can absolutely follow me on Utah Farm Gal, and I will try and give you as much info and answer your questions there as I can.
So Instagram, maybe we can put that on Facebook and so people can follow you there. I know the KSL Greenhouse Show Instagram follows you, and there's lots of good videos.
I try.
You're wonderful at your videos.
Oh, thanks.
Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Sheridan Hansen with you this morning, taking your calls and questions. We've been talking about heirloom tomatoes. One of the listeners wants to know where you get your seeds.
Oh, so many places. So I'm kind of a seed ninja. I source from a number of places. A lot of the times I'll get things from Johnny Seeds. I will get things from rareseeds.com, which is, oh gosh, it just, Baker Creek. It just escaped my brain. Also, there's a website that I get a lot of really funky tomatoes on called Secret Seed Cartel. And they are out of France. And they will ship to you. And there are some really cool things. That's where I'm getting a lot of the micro dwarf tomatoes is from them. They've kind of specialized in some of the micro dwarfs. So if you go to secretseedcartel.com and type in micro or dwarf, it will pop right up and you can work your way through some of those different and unique types of plants that work in small spaces.
Okay, so. And they were talking about, somebody wanted to know what was the small, the micro dwarf, and it's the Groovy Tunes.
Groovy
the one
Tunes.
You mentioned.
Yeah, that's the one I fell in love with. I think I grew like 7 different types in my own garden of those last year, and that one was by far my favorite.
7 different types of the Groovy Tunes?
Of the micro dwarfs.
Oh, I'm like, what?
Yeah, of the micro dwarfs.
So you actually grew some micro dwarfs also, Maria.
Because you were so kind that you gave me the plants.
So these were, I think, from Park Seed.
Yes, they have some also.
They do. Some of them were super productive and some weren't.
And I also learned that if I planted them in a larger pot, they did so much better than if I tried to keep them in a smaller, like 10 inch or whatever. They did really well, actually more like a cherry tomato, just a regular cherry tomato.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that's a really good lesson because we don't think about the size of the root mass on some of these plants, and they do have an extensive root system, tomatoes do, so they do need a larger container.
So while they might not take as much space as far as their size, their roots do love to just spread out.
They do. They like to spread.
So have you ever ordered from Totally Tomatoes?
Yes, I've ordered from Totally Tomatoes a few times. I cannot remember what I got from them right off the top of my head, but I have. And they have, you know, good selections as well. There are so many places. Like you mentioned Park Seed, they have excellent, excellent products as well. Very well tested, great germination rates. You know,
Park Seed, one of the reasons I buy seed from them is they have excellent customer service. I can call them and ask them about their vegetables, and they've occasionally been willing to donate seeds for research. And so at Park Seed, their selection, I mean, it's not really exclusive, but they have how they do things, and they do have a lot of these patio tomatoes in the kitchen. They call them, is it Kitchen Window? They have a series that the micro dwarfs, but Parks has always been friendly to the homeowner, although they do sell commercially, and they've had great customer service.
And I think that goes a long way. I mean, to be able to call and talk to them and ask questions or if something's wrong, I think that that's excellent.
Yeah, Johnny's, you know, I don't know if it's because we're with the university or whatever, but Johnny's has had pretty good customer service.
Absolutely. And you know what I love about them is on Johnny's site, you can go to the growing information on each one, and it gives you so much information. Like, there is no way that you can not be successful sitting down with all of the information that they provide. And they have gone the extra mile to try and help people to grow better. And so I love the information on their sites.
Yeah, I mean, here locally, Trueleaf Market, they do things differently. You don't just pop in and shop for seeds. You can look at their catalog and then they'll pull an order for you. But Trueleaf, you can go online and put your order in, and they'll pull it and email you when it's, or text you when it's ready, and you just pick it up, or you can have it shipped.
Which is what I always do. I just have them ship it to me because, you know, we're busy, right?
We are.
Everybody gets really busy. The other thing, I, you know, if you're not going to grow seeds, but you still want that heirloom tomato, you know, in that garden, there are so many nurseries that have hopped on board with the heirloom tomato scene. And you may not get the variety that you would get from a seed catalog, but you can still grow heirloom tomatoes or some of these micro dwarfs. They're out there and you can find them. And so I know that some of our larger nurseries are growing them. I believe Mill Creek Gardens here in Salt Lake, J&J has some up in Davis County. There are a number of nurseries. And Tawn, you probably know the ones south of us.
Well, if south of us, there's going to be Cooks usually has a number of them in. Linden Nursery will have a number in. And then on the south end of the county, Olson's Garden Shop and Laura Kay's, they're starting to expand a little bit. They've got some fairly new owners that are doing a lot of good things.
Right. But, I mean, even just visiting with some of your local nurseries and telling them, I would love to see more heirloom tomatoes. Sometimes that makes a huge difference and they will bring them in for you. I've had nurseries do that for me.
Well, and they wouldn't if they didn't sell.
Right. Yeah. So just conversations and visiting and supporting those local nurseries is also really important.
So Terry is asking where he can buy the Goldman's Italian tomato seeds. He or she, I'm not sure.
Okay. So let me see where it is. I mean, I'll have to look it up, but I'll get back to you as soon as I find it.
Okay.
I can't remember where I sourced it.
The next question what is the best heirloom tomato for volume and taste for sauces?
Oh, for sauces. So there is, there's a number. So some of the Costelotto type varieties will produce a lot. And they are a small kind of saucer shaped ruffled tomato. They are a little bit harder to peel though, but they are a sauce tomato. They're a traditional Italian sauce tomato. You can also use them for slicing. But to kind of go around that, when I make a sauce out of those, I'll put them in the blender and I'll just blend the heck out of them with the skins on. You don't even know they're there. And then I cook down my sauce from there. But those are prolific. There's a Marsalotto that is also really prolific. And I think that one's even more productive than the Costelotto. So there are a number. And the Goldman's that I mentioned, it produces huge fruit and a good number of them for sauces as well. You can use those.
Did you find the seed catalog?
Oh, I'm working on it. Sorry.
Okay. Next person wants to know, when should they start planting their tomato seeds?
6 weeks before your average last frost. So for most of northern Utah, along the Wasatch Front, that would be late March into early April for colder mountain valleys, early April into mid-April.
Okay, and let's see, one more question before we take a break. How do you treat, Tawn, the shot hole disease? Is it getting close to time to spray for that? This comes from Barry in Highland.
It is not getting close to treat for shot hole. At the delayed dormant spray, that's when you're going to do it. And a delayed dormant oil will help, but you may need to mix that with a fungicide or a number of other, you know, products out there. But it's still a bit early.
Okay, with the Goldman's Italian, it looks like it's available on restorationseeds.com or renaissancefarms.org. And I think I've ordered from Renaissance Farms in the past. So,
okay, I'm taking notes. Okay. And the number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us at 57500. When we come back, Lauren, you're up next. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Tawn, and Sheridan with you this morning, taking your calls at 801-575-8255, or you can text us at 57500. We have Lauren on the line. And Roy, good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. We bought this house about 3 years ago. It has a what we believe is a southern catalpa, kind of umbrella-shaped tree, really old tree, trunk about 2 feet diameter, but hasn't been cared for real well. We've got branches that are crossing over, hanging way low to the ground. Just wondering, how much can we prune this back is to try to get some of this taken care of? It looks like we might have to take like 30 to 40% of the tree. Would that be okay for this? Or should we kind of hold back, try to keep to the 20% over a couple of years?
I wouldn't recommend taking the 20% a year. And I would start with the worst branches, maybe the ones that are posing a safety hazard. They're too low. You know, if the tree's been there for years, and even though it has some crossing branches, if they're not touching, and, you know, in the next 15 or 20 years they're not going to, they may be okay. You know, when a tree's that big, I hate to do a lot of pruning in it. But I would start with the worst branches, and then you work your way toward others that can wait. But do as minimal as pruning as you can to get the job done.
There are some that are rubbing as they cross, so should we put those at the higher priority?
Yeah, so those would be at a higher priority, but you know, you would want to either hire a professional arborist with references that's certified, or go in and look at how to make those pruning cuts if you can, and just go from that direction. But it's, I mean, it may be for 20% of the canopy, you cut out one or two limbs, and that's it.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
All right, Lauren, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener is super frustrated with their hanging pots that they plant or that they grow. Yeah, that they grow every year. They say they can't decide if they're overwatering them or underwatering them. They just don't look that great. They end up dead. What are some of your suggestions for taking care of those hanging pots?
So they are heavy feeders usually as well. So a lot of fertilizer, not tons, but you want to have a nice water-soluble type of fertilizer every week, every other week, something like that, to really produce growth and bloom. And then adequate water is so important because they're in a smaller space for that root. There's not a lot of water holding capacity there. So you're going to be watering, depending on the temperature, maybe once a day, once every other day, and also based on the location. If they're in full sun, you're definitely going to be watering more often. So I usually will use my finger. I think that's one of the best tools in the garden is our hands, and feel the top of the soil. And if it starts to feel dry in that top inch, definitely the top 2 inches, then you're going to be wanting to water. But because we water so frequently, the nutrients wash out so quickly. And if you're not replacing nutrients often, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, then, you know, you're not going to get the bloom. You're not going to get that lush growth.
Ton, next listener says, you always talk about waiting till February or March to prune trees. Can you discuss the right time for different fruit and other non-fruit trees? This person says they have an overgrown cherry tree that they need help with. And also, do you have suggestions for finding a trusted arborist?
Well, as far as pruning timing, shade trees generally mid-January to early February. Get it done if you need to. And then fruit trees, pears and apples, in mid-February, and the stone fruits, including cherries, in mid-March. And if you have ornamental cherries, that would also be mid-March. So what else was...
They wanted to know if you have a suggestion for finding a trusted arborist.
Call Utah Community Forest Council. They do have a website with arborists on there. Honestly, I like to look up who their leadership is and then call one of those people. They're generally fairly well qualified. Okay. So that would be one source. Sometimes local garden centers have arborists that they work with that you could talk to and get references from them too.
All right. Next person, Sheridan, wants to know, can several different heirlooms be planted in the same area?
Oh, absolutely. They won't generally cross-pollinate because they are self-pollinating. And the way the tomato flower is formed, it kind of prevents a lot of cross-pollination through wind anyway. So you're not going to have problems with that. You're not going to have problems with, you know, usually disease contamination from plant to plant, unless we're dealing with something that moves from plant to plant, like curly top or something like that that's moved by an insect. You're not going to have problems. So yes, you can plant them adjacent to each other. Just make sure the next year you rotate to a different section of your garden.
Next texter wants to know, what's a good tomato for planting on a patio in a pot?
Oh, there's so many, and we need to talk about this. You know, those micro dwarfs that we've been talking about are excellent for putting in containers because they are small and they are prolific and they do produce a lot of tomatoes for their size. So any of those are excellent. And then if you go to like burpee.com and you just look up patio tomatoes, it will bring up all types of varieties that they have found do well in containers or have been bred to be a little bit smaller. So there are resources for you, you know, through places like Burpee and some of these seed sellers. You can do the same on Johnny's.
Next person lives in the Heber Valley, and they want to know if you have any tomato suggestions for their short growing season.
Oh, short season tomatoes. Celebrity is how many days? I want to say 75.
Around 75.
Right. So
4th of July.
Yeah, I'd stick with some of those shorter varieties. So when you look
Early Girl.
Yeah, when you look at the seed packets, it will tell you how many days to maturity. Get them started, get them potted up in bigger pots and containers, and then move them outdoors as soon as the temperatures are above 50, yeah. 55.
So I always throw 4th of July in my mix of tomatoes because, you know, is it the best tomato? No, but if I get it outside in May, sometime between the first and second week of May, I always have tomatoes by mid-July.
Right.
Always. Now, and they're better than the store-bought tomatoes. They're not going to be a good, you know, Brandywine or even Celebrity, but they're a pretty good tomato. Early Girl is usually about 2 to 3 weeks later, but in the Heber area, Colville, Cache Valley, colder areas of Cache Valley, I think the 4th of July and Early Girl are very reliable. There's another one called Oregon Spring.
Yes.
That is quite early that they could try too.
Yeah, and I would utilize as much season extension as you could. So use a wall of water and use some of those techniques.
Put
some
black plastic down on top of the furrow and plant with drip irrigation under the plastic. So the plastic warms the soil, and when the tomato is smaller, warms the tomato up.
Right. Yeah. So there are ways to do it. You just have to get kind of tricky.
All right. We are going to take a break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, we're going to talk about budget-friendly ways to garden in small spaces. We all know that our spaces are getting smaller and smaller, so we're going to check that out when we come back. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500.
Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey. It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan Hansen joining us this morning. Sheridan, a horticulturist who has joined us on a number of occasions to talk about all sorts of things, from heirloom tomatoes to extending the gardening season. So you can talk to her about a number of different things or ask your questions of her. We want to start at the top of the hour here, though, talking about gardening in small spaces. We all know that properties are getting smaller and smaller, and people still want to be able to grow their vegetables, but they don't have a lot of space. So we want to talk about some budget-friendly ideas for folks. But first, I guess you have to decide what you're going to plant, what
Absolutely.
You need to plant or want to plant.
Well, and I would say the top tip for somebody with a small space garden is to make sure that you plant what you love and what you know you're going to eat. You don't want to waste one single inch of space on something that you will not like or will not eat. So that space is a hot commodity. So make sure that your selections reflect that. And then, you know, after that, you know, we're looking at spacing plants, we're looking at sourcing smaller plants, we're looking at, you know, making sure that we are packing as much into that space as possible. And this is something I did when I was with USU, as I worked on an urban farm demonstration garden where we worked to pack in as much as we could in a small space as possible. We were growing vegetables in about a 2,000 square foot space, which for some people that's quite large, but for a small scale farmer, that's very small. And we were consistently harvesting between 2,000 and 3,000 pounds of food out of that space. So it can be done. You can pack a lot into that space. But you know, we just have to be mindful about what we pick. Additionally to spacing things close together and picking small varieties, there are other ways that we can do things, and that's like using vertical space, because that's not going to use that space that's spread out in the garden. I'm going to take my tomatoes, I'm going to trellis them upward, I'm going to trellis my beans and my peas upward if I can. Everything that can climb, including squashes, I'm going to push upward so that I can save that space. And I use things that are relatively inexpensive, things like what you would call a hog panel or a cattle panel. You can pick these up at local farm stores. They're not very expensive. You need a couple of T-posts and some zip ties. They're usually about 16 feet 16 feet long, and you can bend them up and over a walkway, or you can use them straight down a row to kind of pull things up down a row if you don't want to have the arch that you walk underneath. There are a couple of different ways to use them, and then I will trellis and push all of those vegetables upward as much as I can. Even cucumbers we've done upward. So that's one way to save space. Another way is to utilize every other little space in your garden by placing containers, or you can interplant, which I've done a lot. You know, I had an uncle that lived in the avenues in Salt Lake. We all know how small some of those yards are. And he would interplant vegetables within his flower beds. So, you know, you'd just be walking along and there's an eggplant and there's a cherry tomato spilling over his little rock wall. And, you know, every little inch of space that you can use, definitely utilize it as you want to. But there are ways to pack these things in and really get a good harvest out of that small space.
Yeah, one of the things people can know that we did do some videos on some of these things that they can find on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel. But one of the interesting things from one of those videos is just how beautiful you can incorporate some of these things into like your flower bed.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they have, I think it was the peppers that had interesting foliage and fruit that really would look great with your flowers.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like even those eggplants, that's like that jewel that stands out in that garden as you're walking through. You're seeing, you know, bedding plants and perennials. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, those colored peppers or that eggplant just poking out at you. And it's interesting. It's beautiful. There is no reason that vegetables can't be incorporated into our landscape. And this is called edible landscaping. And that is something that a lot of urban, you know, in people in urban settings are doing.
You've talked about different things that we can use, different ways to place it in the yard, but there are also, again, you mentioned different plants, but not the plants specifically. So what kinds of smaller varieties of things can we choose that will make a difference?
Right. So you can find, like I've kind of led to this in our last discussion, if you weren't there, this will catch you up, but there are places where you can go to source seeds, things like Burpee, Park Seed, Johnny Seeds. When you go to those websites, you're going to type in container or patio, and it will bring up a host of different plants that you can source that are for smaller spaces. They make cucumbers, mini-me's. You know, there's a number of different cucumber varieties that are out there now. I've tried the mini-me's. Those are great. They're small. They don't vine as much as the larger cucumbers. Like if you plant a lemon cucumber, that thing is massive. It's taking over the garden, where some of these smaller type varieties will not take up nearly as much space, and they lend themselves well to a larger container. So you can get a good sized container and pop them in there if you don't have space in the garden, and you can utilize them there, or you can trellis them upwards at that point as well. So, you know, when you go to these sites, make sure you're searching for smaller varieties, container or patio types.
So I want you to give us your favorite smaller type in each of kind of the different categories. So you mentioned the mini-me's.
Yes.
Now, and your favorite smaller dwarf tomato would be?
Any of the dwarf tomatoes are fabulous. I did Groovy Tunes this last year, and I absolutely loved that one. There's also a green one called Fat Frog that was really good.
Frog.
I mean, they have such great names, don't they? And
they
I'm like,
do.
Okay, what are you saying if I like this thing
I
called
I can remember
Fat
that,
Frog?
Though, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely. most of the peppers are smaller, so you don't really need to worry about smaller variety peppers. If you want to plant one or two peppers, that's great. So this is where it comes into what can I grow successfully as well. So some of the sweet peppers are a little bit more difficult to grow. So if you don't want to really try your hand at sweet peppers and waste that space on something that you may not know how to grow quite yet, grow a hot pepper. They're a lot easier to grow. And again, small kind of plant. Things that I would steer clear from, you know, are some of these larger plants, like, you know, an heirloom tomato is very, very large. As much as I love them, they're not going to lend themselves well to that small space. So thinking about, you know, how can I get that in that smaller variety? And that's where we go to those micro dwarfs. Onions, I don't know if I'd waste space on onions. They're pretty, you know, if you've got a very small garden, I would probably
just
pick those up at the store.
Veer toward green onions or chives.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think I'd waste my time on, you know, the bulbing onions at that point if I was dealing with a really small space.
And chives do so well.
They do. And herb gardens are fabulous in containers. So if you want to grow an herb garden, you know, do something in a container because it's beautiful too. I have an old bathtub that was left on my property when I moved in, mm-hmm. and I've turned that into my herb garden. And
wonderful.
So this old nasty iron bathtub that is so heavy to move, we moved it over to a different space in the garden where it would get sun, and that has become the site for all of my herbs.
You're thinking out of the box?
Yeah.
Out of the bathroom?
Out of the bathroom. Oh, my gosh.
It's where I do my best thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. No.
So, Ton, somebody was asking about the love melons that we had mentioned in another show. Are those one of the smaller melons?
Yes,
that...
they are the little single-serve melons that only get 2 or 3 feet long. So you would still need a bigger container so that you can get satisfactory rooting so you can actually get the melons. But there are several varieties of little grapefruit-sized cantaloupe and watermelon that you can also grow on patios.
Right. There's a tiger melon as well that you can get from Baker's Creek that is small. It's like a single serving, which is awesome. And they're really fragrant and really delicious.
Tigger.
Yeah, and they're striped, like what you would think about, you know, Tigger on Winnie the Pooh, kind of stripey.
Okay,
yeah.
We can remember that one as well. Okay, and we can continue talking about this if you have other questions that you would like to ask Sheridan or Ton. You know, I just kind of pop in every once in a while, so I'm not very good at answering your questions, but I'm here for you. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan with you this morning. We've been talking about planting in small spaces, and Sheridan, you thought it would be important that we also talk about succession planting.
Absolutely. Succession planting and interplanting both are really important practices to get more out of that garden space. So during the break, we were talking a little bit about successions where you would plant multiple crops or multiple successions of the same crop. So I do this to really irritate my kids sometimes. I'll plant, you know, beets once, and then a couple weeks later, I'll plant beets again, and then we have beets throughout the entire summer. And what do they not want? They don't want beets. I want them, but they don't.
Yeah,
they're so good. But, you know, a teenager, that's not necessarily on their high priority to eat list. So they get upset with me. But it's a way to utilize that same space multiple times throughout the season and also to get that crop to come up, you know, within a longer period of time. So instead of having to deal with this huge row of beets all at once, it gives me time to deal with them, you know, as they come on throughout that season because I have succession planted. And then also interplanting. And this is where, you know, maybe we'll plant, and this kind of gets muddy in the water. This is the succession planting and the interplanting. But maybe we'll plant, you know, French radishes early in the season. And those are really short-lived crop, and then those come out, and then I'm going to plant something else, or I plant them to the side. So I've got tomatoes growing, but to the side, those tomatoes aren't fully sized yet, so I can plant radishes or peas to the side or something like that, and then I can take those out and allow the tomatoes to continue to fill that space. And we're basically getting, you know, a 2-for-1, getting a bigger bang for our buck in that space. We just kind of have to think outside the box a little bit.
You do. I mean, if you look at historic, we wouldn't really call them homesteading books, but books on how to grow vegetables if you were living on several acres with your family. This is just an accepted principle that every space in your garden has at least 2 different crops growing on it through the growing season, and in warmer areas up to 3. And so you would start, as Sheridan said, maybe with French radishes. But as soon as those come out, you go back in with your tomatoes or even beets, and then the beets will grow for 45 to 60 days. And then if you have time, you go back in with your fall radishes or fall peas. And so there's several ways to do this. And we don't do it much anymore because we've had space and just, you know, we'd let it go fallow, or if we're really adventurous or wanting to get things done, you might put a green crop in there that you would mulch in later on. But when you were trying to support a family, you know, this was something that you just did, and it was part of gardening.
And I think it's a great practice to maybe think about reinstating, because you are moving. So think about it. You're moving from, you know, one family to the next as far as vegetables are concerned. So we're starting with radishes and maybe we're going to tomatoes or we're going to beets. And that is going to reduce the insect and the pathogen pest load in that space. We're essentially crop rotating at the same time, which is awesome and helps to boost the nutritional value in the soil as well. So we're not constantly taking out the same nutrients out of that soil, you know, with the same crop.
And as you turn the waste in, it's adding organic matter back into the soil. You know, the useful part of the pea is the little pod or the seeds, but then that entire plant goes back into the soil and adds some nitrogen and organic matter. And so you're cycling that way too.
Yeah, it's really sustainable. I really like this idea.
Yes. And so one other thing I wanted to bring up before we go to break, we've got 3 or 4 minutes, is the importance of having pollinator plants in your garden, flowers. You know, my great aunt, I've talked about this several times, she had a huge garden, but always had rows of petunias and marigolds and peonies, and all the flowers she loved, she grew in her garden, interspersed with her vegetables. We might not be able to do that, but can you describe some ways and what you might grow to in a small space to encourage beneficial insects and pollinators?
Yeah, anything flowering is definitely going to bring in some of those insects. And we want things that are open, things that are easy for those insects to get into. So think about, you know, a double ruffled petunia. How easy is it for an insect to get into the center of that plant and access the pollen and the nectar in that plant versus an echinacea or a purple coneflower that is, you know, very open, very easy to access. So we're going to choose plants that are easy for them to get into. And I do this at my house. So in my park strip garden, I have it where it rotates. So I'm super weird here. I've got vegetables out in my park strip garden, but it rotates from, you know, pollinator plants to vegetables. And I have this kind of pattern that goes back and forth where they're kind of interspersed with each other. And it brings in so many pollinators. Anything native, I've got penstemon, I have hyssop. Hyssop is an incredible pollinator plant. You would not believe the diversity that shows up on hyssop.
You're talking the
I've got a couple
Agastache.
Yeah, Agastache. I've got a couple of different types of it. But having those plants there, it boosts the amount of vegetable that I get because they are there pollinating and they just happen to swing by my other plants and do the pollination while they're there. Plus, I've got the beneficial insects that help keep things like aphids down. Last year, I had a problem with aphids on some of my brassicas, and I had the parasitic wasps come in and just decimate the aphids. It was incredible to watch.
Yeah, I would dare say that if you're growing pollinator plants with your vegetables, and you have, 25-30% pollinator plants to 2/3 vegetables, you will rarely even need to use an organic insecticide in your garden.
Right. And I mean, if you can't get them into the vegetable garden, do them in your borders around the edges of your yard and get them there so that you have that access to those beneficials and the pollinators.
Okay, I want to squeeze Sue in here, who has been waiting very patiently on the line. Good morning, Sue. What was your question?
Good morning. I have a question about transplanting small trees. Right now they are growing about 3 feet from the mother tree, and I want to transplant them but also keep them both safe. What's the best way to dig those up?
Do you know what kind of tree it is?
Yes, I have a bur oak that has little saplings and also a lodgepole pine.
So they're probably seedlings, I'm assuming, if it's bur oak and not gamble. So I would dig that. At 3 feet, it doesn't seem like it's very tall, but the root system on that 3-foot little seedling is going to be very extensive. And so the sooner you can dig it, the better. When those are grown in nurseries, they're root pruned and trained a little bit. And so as soon as the ground is thawed enough to dig, I would move it.
Is there something special to keep from damaging the roots of the mother tree?
No. And you're not going to, if it's a great big tree, you're not going to do a lot of damage digging an 18-inch wide and 18-inch deep hole.
Okay. About 18 inches then.
At least, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call this morning. We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Coming back with more of your questions and calls. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Sheridan Hansen joining us this morning. You can give us a call at 801-575-8255 or text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, wants to know, how do the sugar bay forsythia do along the East Bench in Salt Lake?
As long as they have a full sun exposure, most any forsythia will do fine.
Yeah, forsythia was the plant of the week, so you can find out more about
if
that.
If you are on the bench areas where the homes are, you're usually at an elevation that the way our atmospheric layers work and inversions work, the air is warmer than the valley floor where the homes are on the benches. And so most any forsythia, you're not going to run into much danger of bud damage from cold. So I would just find one you like and grow it.
And the forsythia, again, the plant of the week, you can find more on the Facebook page, the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. When is a good time to trim roses? People are getting excited. This is the second time this morning we've had this question.
So mid-March is the time to grow roses. And if you're getting too antsy, I'm selling a kit to help people not prune too early. And it involves giving the pruners away to somebody and
taking
they have a padlock, but then a rope that you can tie your hands together.
It's an intervention.
It's an intervention. And if you still can't stand it, then I'll give you a refund. If you get a note from your significant other saying that you don't have the moral strength to stop pruning. And you
be
get your
patient.
Refund. But yeah, but the point is be patient.
Okay. Next listener wants to know how to get rid of ants that have burrowed into the center of their snowball bushes and catalpa tree branches.
Bait. There's several of them out there. You might have to try two or three. They are either going to be an oil or fatty-based bait or a sugar-based bait. And the end of the season when the food supply starts to diminish from what they feed on is the easier time. But generally, Amdro makes several of them. Bear makes a few. There's many companies, but just to get to the queen, it takes a little longer. Instead of using Raid or Black Flag, use these baits and let the worker ants carry the poison back to the queen in the colony, and they will, through a process called trophallaxis, they regurge the food into the queen and she eventually dies and that kills the colony.
Ooh, thanks for sharing that.
Yes.
So Sheridan, do you have a recommendation for a green pepper? Someone's asking.
Oh, I love any pepper you can grow is a green pepper because it doesn't turn colors until later into the season. So everything starts out as a green pepper. But California Wonder is a really good one. I love Yellow Monster. You can just pick it green and not let it turn yellow. But that one's really prolific and produces really long, pretty good-sized peppers.
A good cantaloupe to plant?
Ooh, I'm into ambrosia right now. That's kind of my favorite. I planted one by mistake, and that was the best mistake I ever made.
Ooh. Farm I worked on for years grew, I think, ambrosia is one of their varieties, and it was always a favorite.
Oh, it's so tasty.
Okay, Fred is on the line. I got to go to Bill first. Bill is on the line in Grantsville. Good morning, Bill. What was your question?
Good morning. My question is how to plant Brussels sprouts and if you have any recommendations for varieties.
So Brussels sprouts are tough. They are a really long season crop, like 120 days at least. So get them started soon, very, very soon in containers. Or you can source them from a nursery. They'll start them at the appropriate time. You've got to get them out into the garden as soon as possible, usually early April to mid-April, depending on your weather. And then you're going to, fertilize them appropriately, water them appropriately, decent amount of water. They don't like to be drought stressed. Make sure that you control aphids. That's going to be your biggest problem on Brussels sprouts is aphids. So you can just a strong stream of water every morning just really does help keep the aphids down. And then I like to pull off the bottom leaves as they grow. That gives the little Brussels sprouts an opportunity to really kind of size up. So as soon as you see those start to form around those leaves, you can go and snip those leaves right off and then leave the top leaves on for photosynthesis. So they're going to kind of look like a palm tree. But you will not harvest the Brussels sprouts until end of October. So very long season crop, and it requires a lot of patience. You know, there are some really good standard Brussels sprouts. If you just go to Johnny's Seeds and look up Brussels sprouts, every variety that they sell on Johnny's is excellent. And there's a purple type, there's a green type that they sell. I've grown all of them, and they do very well. But it just requires patience.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Next listener wants to know, Ton, when they can start pruning their lilacs into tree forms. Apparently their trees are about 5 years old.
Sometime after they stop blooming, just to get the flowers, if they don't really care and it's more important to get them trained, sometime in mid-March.
Next listener says they used to grow a tomato plant named Heartland, and they loved it because of its compact size and beautiful tomatoes, and they can no longer find that variety, and they're wondering if there's anything similar.
You know, I have not grown that one myself. I'm seeing it at Sierra Vista Growers. I'm just pulling that up. But, yeah, it's a nice compact. It looks like a very nice compact type of tomato. But I would say, you know, it's a nice red, easy slicer. So even Better Boy would be an excellent substitute for that one. That one I found, you know, does get a little bit larger. Celebrity stays a little bit smaller. That would also work for that one. It looks very similar to that. But I am doing a quick search, and I'm seeing it in a few places. So you might want to do a little search.
Okay.
You might want to do a little search, and you might want to check out places like Seed Savers Exchange and some of those more informal sites where people just exchange.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Fred is on the line in Lighton. Good morning, Fred. What was your question?
I'm looking for tips on pruning a rose of Sharon. It's in what they call a lollipop tree.
So it's on a single trunk?
Yes.
Okay, and what are you trying to do with it? Just keep it in shape or?
Yes, the shape.
I would use a process called renewal pruning, to where you're taking a third of the oldest branches out and cutting it toward where, not, you know, don't get to do a pruning cut at the base, obviously, but toward where the bush actually is you're going to take a third of those branches and cut them as close to the middle of it as you can. And then you can give it a haircut afterwards. But if you cut a third of the branches out every year and then give it a light haircut, that will keep it in check. It'll kind of keep that ball shape, and it'll keep it blooming like crazy through the last half of the summer.
It doesn't hurt then to cut the ends off?
No, they bloom off new growth. You don't just want to give it a haircut. You want to cut a third of the branches out every year so that, you know, you're always cutting out three-year-old branches, or at least 25%, so you're cutting out four-year-old branches, but you're taking the biggest branches out toward the middle.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says, if they trimmed their roses last week, is that going to kill them with a big oops?
No, it's not probably going to get cold enough. I wouldn't worry too much. If we were getting down into single digits, maybe.
All right. We're going to take a break, come back with the final segment of the show. I'm not going to promote the phone lines or the text because we are getting close to the end and we have so many still to answer. So stay with us. Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. Maria, Ton, and Sheridan taking your calls and questions for the last few minutes of the show here. Let's get to Alan, who's on the phone lines in Pleasant View. And good morning, Alan. What was your question?
Oh, can you hear me all right?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. I built a home a little over a year ago, and there was an old cherry tree that we just loved and wanted to try to keep. I would have to say, based on the property owners, that it could be nearly 50 years old. It's probably a little over 30 feet tall. And last spring, the leaves didn't come on too healthy looking, and it continued to get worse. They never turned yellow or fell off. They just didn't look vibrant. After we cut out some of the dead wood from the previous fall, some of the new branches that came out of the dock, they looked vibrant and green, but the whole rest of the tree, it just doesn't look good. My question is it salvageable? Do you fertilize them in the spring? And those are some of my questions.
Well, and Sheridan, you can chip in on this too. At 50 years old, I don't know you know, short of doing some pruning and things, I don't know that it's worth trying to salvage the tree because it's just on the decline no matter what at that age.
And the height. I mean, how conducive is it to pick cherries 30 feet off the ground? I mean, so to me, in my mind, it's transitioned to a shade tree, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would go, if you like those old cherries, there's a 70% chance that it's Bing, which is still widely available, maybe Lambert, because that was another wildly popular cherry back in the day. But I would go grab another Bing or a Lambert cherry and see if you can find them. And it's sometimes hard, but graft it onto maybe like Gisela 6 or Gisela 12, because those will max out at about 12 to 15 feet if you don't prune them.
Yeah, I it's not so much for the fruit as it is just the nostalgia of having a nice big old tree on a brand new piece of property.
Yeah, and I just, it's just one of those things that it sounds like it has some vascular wilt in it, and sometimes pruning invigorates the tree temporarily, but within the next 5 to 10 years at the most, I think it's probably going to decline.
So plant a great shade tree or another cherry next to it while that one declines, and let, you know, while the other one gets growing. And then you'll have something when it's finally time
to
take it out.
I mean, you could plant another cherry on Mahalab rootstock, which will get that same size. It'll be 15, 20 years down the road, but you could put in a Bing cherry on Mahalab and it would be a great big tree.
Okay. All right. That was what I thought you would say, because it feels like maybe at this point it's better to make some firewood and plant another tree.
Make some good smoking wood.
Yeah.
Wood.
Thanks so
All right,
much
thank
for
you
your
much.
Call today. Next listener says they're wondering about the park strip, and I guess they're concerned about things that get sprayed on it, probably animal spray as well as salt spray, and they're wondering what would be some good things that you could plant in the park strip that you wouldn't have to worry about that will do well.
So I haven't had a problem with this, and I've been running a park strip garden for a number of years now. You know, the biggest concern I have is salt spray in the winter, and I do live on a corner piece of property that has a huge amount of park strip, and, you know, we do get a lot of snow up on the bench where I live. I haven't seen problems with it, but if you are concerned about that, you want to select plants that are tough, that are adapted to Utah soils and climate, that can withstand a little bit of salt. If somebody is coming and spraying herbicide on that park strip where you live, and that's something that shouldn't be done without your knowledge. So, you know, that's not normal practice in cities that I've dealt with when I worked with Extension. So, but I would definitely select things that are a little more water wise, a little bit tougher. So look at some of those native plant lists and some of those adapted plant lists. There's some on the USU Botanical Center. If you look at the pollinator garden there, I have left a list there that you can look through.
All right. Next sister wants to know if you guys have tried the Azoichka or Cosmonaut Volkov tomatoes, and do they grow well here, and do they even taste good?
So the Azoichka is a yellow tomato. I have not grown either of these varieties personally, but Azoichka is available through True Leaf Market, which is a local company. All of these tomatoes typically grow well here. They're an annual, so we're not going to be overwintering. So we're just growing for the season. It's usually not an issue to grow any of these types of tomatoes here. And then the Cosmonaut, that one is a more northern type variety. It looks like it withstands some of the colder temperatures, but it's a nice little red slicer tomato. And I have not grown that one either, but I don't foresee any problems with that growing here.
Next listener, Ton, has a 12 by 12 container garden. They want to know what product they should use to replace the nutrients in the soil. This is Mike, and he wants to know, when should he do it?
I actually would consider just replacing the soil every 2 to 3 years. If you're using potting soil, it decomposes over, especially after that second year, and it loses its good qualities. But in the meantime, I would just use an Osmocote Complete fertilizer or something similar, the slow release that has all the micronutrients in it. So these pots are going to be hard to reuse the soil over and over. And so after that, after I've gardened in that soil twice and grown different plants the next year, different species, I put it in a flower bed and just lightly rake it into the compost or soil in the flower beds and replace it.
Okay, next listener, I think this is more of a comment than a question. They planted a wildflower bee mix into their garden from Territorial Seed. They didn't even know that there were that many different varieties of bees around, and they had thousands of bumblebees in their garden from little to bump. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Had
thousands of bees.
Yeah, that's awesome. Utah is a hot spot for native bee diversity. There are more species of bees here in Utah than there are in the entire eastern seaboard, basically. So we have over 1,000 different documented varieties. So native bees are incredibly important. And if you do plant, you will see a huge diversity.
Okay. Next listener says they had a bumper crop of English walnuts. Do you have any hints on how to crack them? The shell is so hard that the nutcrackers don't work. And any way to lessen the amount of shaft left on the nuts after they're cracked?
We're wanting our cake and eat it too on this
one. They're just tough ones, huh?
There are some commercial nutcrackers available that will not break with those hard walnuts. Mm-hmm. I've seen people make a shallow box tall enough for their car to drive over. And they drive over the nuts and then try to get them that way. A hammer. But those hard black walnuts are just something that are machine cracked. And they use the black walnuts in pastries and confectioneries because they have a stronger flavor. But they are very hard for homeowners to manually crack without a hammer.
Okay, next person lives in Huntsville. They believe that's a zone 5. Will a peach tree grow there? And what would you suggest as a good eating variety?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, will Contender grow there? I think it might. Yeah,
it will.
So that might be your option.
That's probably the best one. Contender, even Red Haven probably would. It grows well in Logan. A PF24C, Madison is another one that's a pretty good peach.
Yeah. But, you know, you definitely don't want to grow some of those marginal
varieties.
No
Albertas.
Yeah, you want to stick to those
O'Henry's.
Tougher ones.
No O'Henry's.
Mm-hmm. What about apples?
Almost any apple.
Apples will do really well there.
I would avoid Fuji, avoid Honeycrisp, avoid
Pink Lady's a little too late.
But otherwise, anything that ripens up to Golden Delicious will be fine.
Yeah.
Okay, next listener says there was a purple red tatsoi at home. Is that a, I don't know if that's an autocorrect. Mild flavor for salads, very ornamental plant. Do you know that variety or can you recommend a variety?
So tatsoi is like a bok choy. There are purple varieties out there. They all grow really well. The trick with these types of plants is to get them in the ground early and to succession plant because they will all come into use at the same time. So you want a succession plant, but you can choose really any variety. And these are cool season crops, so they won't do well once our temperatures are in the 80s, 85, 90.
Okay, next person says, when a seed catalog says for hoop house growing, are those different than those to start inside and then plant outside?
So hoop house growing, this is where we are growing like in a caterpillar tunnel. And so we're going to be starting these early. It's really commercial production. You can grow these out into your own vegetable garden. There's no reason why you can't.
A lot of the tomatoes I grow are hoop house varieties and they do wonderfully outside.
Yeah.
Okay. Next listener says, can they grow pine nuts in northern Utah County?
In theory. So
that's
we're
it.
Both
that's
looking
all
at
you're
each
giving
other.
Us.
Like, it's if you plant a Pinus edulis, so what's the common name?
Pinyon pine.
Pinyon pine.
Yeah.
It will be 25 to 30 years before you ever get nuts off of it, at least sometimes up to 50.
So you might just want to go forage somewhere.
Plant it for the grandchildren.
Yeah.
Oh, that doesn't sound very satisfying.
No.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Sheridan, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We didn't get to one of my favorite topics, and that's unique types of vegetables people don't plant. We're going to have you come back.
Yeah, I'm happy to come back. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah,
this has been a blast.
Thanks for being here. And we have done a number of videos that you can check out on the KSL Greenhouse YouTube channel on those unique vegetables, container gardening, how to plant early in the season, all sorts of things. So check those out. Anton, have a great week.
You also.
And thanks again for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Catch us on podcast.